The more people you have following you, the more income potential you have. You go into LinkedIn, go into Instagram, and just go out there, build your profile, write books, create content, put it out on a regular basis, and you're going to start seeing the fruits of that come through in big time sales.
You're listening to Business Lunch with Roland Frazier. This is your seat at the table. In today's episode, Roland is talking to Kevin Harrington. Kevin is the inventor of the infomercial and one of the original hosts of Shark Tank. So listen out for how Kevin has a remarkable ability to see and seize opportunities and turn them into gold.
Welcome to Business Lunch. I'm Roland Frazier, and I'm also excited to be here with my friend Kevin Harrington today. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Roland. Great to be here.
Thank you for making the time. And wanted to just kind of start out talking about, you've done so many things. You are the inventor of the infomercial. You were one of the founders of ERA, the Electronic Retailing Association, and also Entrepreneurs Organization.
EO, correct. Yeah.
Which has about 12,500 members last time I checked, and is a global organization. And so many really, really cool things. One of the original sharks for two seasons on Shark Tank.
Thank you.
So how do you get started? Tell us where you came from and what was the evolution into getting into your first business?
I started a driveway ceiling business when I was 15.
Okay.
Because I worked for my father for a number of years after school, worked a 40-hour week when I was a kid, 11 years old to 15, and a lot on the weekends too. But my dad said, get something going, because there wasn't a lot of money for me, so I had to pay my own way through high school, actually. If I wanted things to have, you know, my friends had came from a little bit more money, I think, in the neighborhood that we lived in. And so I was fortunate to be able to earn my own income and pay my own way in the early days. So when I started college, I needed a full-time job because I had to pay for college, apartment, my car, my insurance, my books, everything. So I started a heating and air conditioning business. I had, during my senior year in high school, I started selling air conditioning systems and furnaces for another company.
Okay.
And they had a little telemarketing room.
All right.
And so I said, you know, hey, I can get the leads. That's easy. You just outbound telemarket. But I said, I want to get good leads. How do I get the best leads? So I was doing data mining, and I went to the courthouse and I got all the transactions of a homeowner sales. And there was literally hundreds a week. So we outbound telemarketed the people that just bought a new house. And our pitch was, hey, look, the furnace is a dangerous appliance in your home. You know, it's shooting out carbon monoxide. Let us come in. We're going to give you a free safety check. And we'll also clean the furnace.
So you had a lead magnet all the way back then. That's awesome.
We were doing a lead magnet for a free furnace cleaning and a safety check. And literally 80% of the people that we got a hold of said, absolutely, come on out and do it.
For this check.
For the check. But I would go along with that guy, because in the world of sales, it's all about getting the lead. So we had tons of great leads. We would get in there, and Carrier had just invented something called spark ignition.
Yeah, yeah.
And so up until, this is the mid-70s now, your furnace had a pilot light that was burned all 24/7, 365 days a year. Now we put a salesman in that home while they're looking at it, and they bring the homeowner down and say, look, you've got one of these old pilot light furnaces. We got a spark ignition we can put in here. It'll save you 20% on your fuel bill day one. Pay for the cost of it. Much more efficient. And we got to where we were selling 10 jobs a week while I was in college. And so that business took off. And I ended up quitting school because I just couldn't do both. It was costing me money not to be at the office because people were making the wrong decisions. We weren't selling as much. And I wanted to be at those homes when we were cleaning the furnaces, because I was a good salesperson at that point. So that was a great business. I was making money, but the labor side of it was terrible.
Right.
I mean, we were installing furnaces,
service business,
humidifiers, electronic air cleaners, and someone, oh, I have no heat now, and I have no, you know, my air conditioner's not getting air back to this back room, which was a problem they had long before we ever installed anything.
Right.
But now it's my problem, right? So I sold the company to one of my employees. And I was sitting at a business broker's office, and I had a bunch of cash from the sale, and, you know, not millions, but the equivalent of probably $500,000 bucks today, in today's money. And I'm looking at bars, restaurants, pizza parlors, laundromats, flower shops, but I didn't want to own any of that.
So you were right? at the business broker saying,
I want to buy something.
Find me something. Yeah. Okay, cool.
And so what was amazing is I'm sitting there looking at this guy. He had 200 businesses for sale. And what did he have? The books and records of every one of them. You know, the rents, the food costs, the percentages, everything that was involved in running in the business, but the numbers for the last 5 years, 10 years, whatever, the leases with the malls. I was a kid in a candy store thinking, wow, I want to see all of that. I want to learn about small business, right?
Right.
So I ended up setting up a business brokerage company.
Yeah. Okay.
So
with that person or just kind of on your own?
No, I did it on my own. So I got a real estate license and said, I can do this. Got a couple of straight commission salespeople, just like opening a real estate office to sell homes. But we sold the building as well as, and sometimes it was just a lease.
Okay.
But we specialized in the sale of the business,
okay.
which was a very special, really business at that particular time. But I got a chance now to help all these people because we'd be sitting at the closing table and they wanted to say, okay, well, should I be a sole proprietorship or corporation, LLC? I need some accounting. Who do you recommend? So I'm referring at the closing table, call this lawyer, call this accountant, call this insurance guy, call this. All of a sudden, I got 20 jobs for all these people. I said, wait, I'm going to bring it all in-house.
Right, right.
So I rented a whole floor of an office building, and now this is 1980, and I called it the Small Business Center. And the business brokerage was in the very middle, and around the outside were all the service providers. They just paid rent, and they brought their clients in who needed help. We would incorporate your business. We would do write your insurance. We did your books. We did your accounting. So Entrepreneur Magazine came along and they heard about what we were doing. It was called the Small Business Center. I went out, I did a story on me. And when I was out there, they had this bookstore in the basement of their operation. They sold all these manuals. And so I'm sitting there watching people as I'm getting interviewed, you know, for the magazine, coming in, buying all these manuals and books. And so I cut a deal on the spot with Entrepreneur to take the Small Business Center and call it the Entrepreneur Magazine Small Business Center. And we opened up 30 of them around the United States.
So that's really cool. That's kind of a big picture thinking thing. So for people to get an idea of how they might do that, talk about that deal just for a little bit. So you saw the opportunity and you're like just there for the first time ever.
I'm sitting there in the lobby waiting to go up to meet with the editor of the magazine. And in the lobby of Entrepreneur Magazine on Sepulveda in Los Angeles, and this is, you know, back in the 80s, I'm watching people come up to the counter and they're buying a $300 manual. I mean, literally watching thousands of dollars in transactions because I was sitting there for probably close to an hour to get my meeting with the editor. And when I got up there, I said, you guys, this is an unbelievable cash machine, this little store. And he said, oh, it's unbelievable. He said, people love this. And then I said, well, I've got the Small Business Center. We could use that as a way to get people in. They don't have to buy a $100,000 laundromat. They can buy the book on how to start your own laundromat.
Right.
Because they had manuals on starting any kind of business.
Right.
Import, export, flower shops, you know, direct marketing businesses, et cetera. So the editor did the interview, took me over to the publisher's office. I pitched the publisher, let's open these all across the country.
What does that pitch look like?
It basically was what I have the model for it, sort of the pilot, and it's working. And so this is found money for the magazine because we can open these up around the country with strategic relationships.
Right.
Accountants, lawyers. We weren't opening a bookstore. We were opening a business that tied into something else.
Right.
Right. So people didn't have to spend a huge amount of money to do this because, like me, I had an office and I could just, you know, put the manuals in there. And so it was an easy turnkey thing.
So what's in it for Entrepreneur?
They were the manufacturer of all the manuals.
So you just said, if I can use your name for free, then I'll be selling lots of your manuals.
I'll be selling your manuals. You'll be the wholesaler of the manuals. And I just want a little commission on all the manual sales to go through all these stores. So they said, there's no downside for us. They just wanted to qualify the people that we were choosing. So that's all we did. We ran a full-page ad in Entrepreneur Magazine that they provided. And we said, would you like to be an entrepreneur for entrepreneurs and open up your own entrepreneur small business center? And boom, it was massive. I mean, we sold 30 of these within about 6 months.
Now, did you do it as a franchise?
We did it as a license.
Okay.
Yeah, because franchising is a little more complicated. And so they kept their own identity.
So they named it, and you just provided the system.
We basically sold them the books.
Yeah, okay.
And so it was a really powerful little business. And then about 2 years later, Entrepreneur Magazine sold to a new group. And the new group that bought it, they ended up having their own ideas and plans. And they didn't love the idea, the new owners, only because there was a little bit of a control issue of,
yeah,
okay, you got 30 guys out there using the name Entrepreneur Magazine. There was never any bad things that happened. It just was something that eventually wound down and sure, they didn't continue.
So what happened with the business? Was it a saleable business?
We did 3-year deals with all the original people. And right, when the new owners came in, they just decided not to renew
the terms.
And they actually did continue with many of them. But there was lots of people coming that wanted to get a license.
Okay.
And they just decided, no, we're just going to stay with the 30 that we've got and, you know, kind of let it wind down.
So what was the takeaway from that for you?
The takeaway was, in hindsight, in doing that, I would have set up a longer term deal, because for me, I got Entrepreneur Magazine to say, let's do this.
That's a pretty big thing.
3 years is actually too short of a term.
Right.
It should have been a 10-year deal.
Okay.
And then, because my income was tied to the sale of the books.
Right.
Right? That was my only income stream coming out of that venture, was the more books they sold, the more money I made. So it sort of ended in 3 years instead of being a 10-year deal.
Right.
And in a 10-year deal, I might have had, let's say the new owner said, look, we don't really want to keep doing this, then buy us out.
Yeah.
Okay. So it was something that was structured as a cool thing, but it also started to bring me deal flow though, because
right,
these 30 offices weren't just selling books. They were looking at products. They were looking at businesses. They were getting pitched from people needing money. So I call it my pre-shark days, uh-huh, because I ended up with equity in a couple different companies, some franchise companies, and we just started, you know, we would take California Closet Company and boom, expand them. We would take El Pollo Loco and, you know, Fantastic Sam's. And, you know, so we were actually helping companies expand also.
How did that happen? So you got equity in those companies as a straight investor, or was it some other kind of deal?
Other deals, you know, I would help them expand and get a piece of equity based on a performance situation.
Okay. Yeah. And what did you do? What kind of expansion? Like, what was the skill set you brought?
For example, there was a company called Stained Glass Overlay. That company, we ended up selling more than 100 franchises for them through the network of these affiliates.
Now, you didn't have any prior experience doing that, right?
No.
So was this just, you're like, okay, well, I sold 30 of these things to an entrepreneur. I can help
other franchise companies.
Okay.
We became a franchise brokerage company.
You did?
Also.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that was another service that we added into the Small Business Center. We also had a company called Franchise America.
Okay.
And Franchise America allowed the Small Business Center to sell franchises also.
Okay.
So they had books to sell, and then they had franchises to sell also.
So a lot of people ask, because I love doing those equity deals also, a lot of people ask, how do you do that? I'd love for you to say, so you've got people coming to you that are franchisors, and they're saying, we'd like to expand.
Right.
And you somehow get a piece of their business. How do you do that?
So, and by the way, I'm still doing it to this day, because we just actually are relaunching here in the last 2 years, a new company that will actually broker franchises.
Oh,
also,
fantastic.
And we take an equity stake where we can.
Nice.
It's easier to get an equity stake when they're a little bit younger of a company.
Right.
You know, so Stained Glass Overlay, we sold 100 franchises for them. Neil Balter, who started California Closet Company, came in. We did not 100, but we helped him sell a few franchises also.
Okay.
El Pollo Loco, we actually, when they came along, we took them. I had a Japanese connection, so we started doing some international events also.
Wow.
And so I went over to Japan, and we sold the master rights for the country of Fantastic Sam's, El Pollo Loco. I was really a small business franchise guy.
Yep.
This was back in the early 80s.
Okay.
Okay. And so we would say, look, you've got 5 locations. We can take you to 100. We want 10% of the company.
Okay.
Okay. And there'd be a clawback.
That's what I was going to ask.
A lot of people would say, what happens if you don't do what you say?
Right.
So they would try to make it like, you'll earn equity as you go. Mm-hmm. We prefer to do it. We want the equity.
And you lose if you don't perform.
You can lose it if we don't, because it's always tougher to get the equity later.
And if there's a buyout along the way, it's kind of nice to have
if
your equity
buyout,
fixed.
Buyout, it all accelerates to, you know, to equity.
Yeah.
Because it's sort of almost like an option, but as long as we're performing, you know, and today we agree to do advisory services. We agree to perform certain services. We don't like to put actual guarantees of X amount of units sold,
right?
Because we're going to provide a lot of help and a lot of service that are going to help the whole company along the way. So we want the equity just for being part of the team, advisory board, board of directors, whatever that might be. But
right.
But again, you claw back as opposed to earn in as you go is the better way to do it.
If you're going
to
be an advisor these days now, yeah. jumping to present, what do you look for in a company? What's the range of equity that you...
Good question. If the company's public... Right now, I'm on a few public boards, probably like five. I generally look for, you know, certainly some kind of block of stock or options. And any more today, depending on how big the company is, it can, in a very small company, you might be able to get 0.5% of the company,
right.
1% of the company, mm-hmm. maybe 2 or 3% of the company. But that's a lot.
It is.
Okay. If it's a NASDAQ company and it's already rolling, you may only get 0.25%
right.
of the company.
Right.
But I joined a company called Celsius. They were a public company, but they were doing only a couple million in sales. Stock was 10 cents a share. And I forget how many shares they had, but I ended up structuring a deal to get close to 1 million shares
right.
Over a period of time. Not all of it on the front end. Generally, with public companies, you're going to earn in.
Yep.
You're going to get it over time.
Yep.
So the good news is I joined the board, and not only did I help them raise capital, you know, a couple of my contacts ended up bringing north of $30 million into the company. We brought influencers in, and now the stock is trading at somewhere in the almost $4 range. So from 10 cents to $4.
From 100,000 to 4 million. That's all right. Right.
And it's a fully NASDAQ full reporting company.
Nice.
And an amazing, you know, it's got a $200 million market cap.
That's
from
awesome.
A couple million bucks. So I love those kind of pictures. I just joined a board of another company called UBID. And UBID was at one point had a $1.8 billion.
I remember
UBID. Cap.
I know one of the guys that was in the beginning of that.
Okay. So UBID, we've just relaunched. And I got 3 million shares of stock. It's very thinly traded right now, but we hope to pop this thing. It's, you know, we're raising capital. We just put $1 million raised together, and we hope to bring it back to the future of where it was before. But I mean, at one time it was eBay's competitor,
mm-hmm.
and we have a couple of the original folks too.
So
a guy named Keaton Thacker. He was in the finance department way back. But anyway, so I like public companies because it's, you can monetize the situation.
Okay. So we go back, and you are doing the franchise consulting with
right.
Franchise America.
Yes.
At the time you had the 30 deals that Entrepreneur decided to kind of let run out.
Yep.
What'd you do next?
So then I was sitting there, I'm watching cable TV. This was in the early 80s now, 84. And so I got the 30-channel cable package. I bought a house and cars and, you know, doing well in business, you know, young entrepreneur. And so I get the 30-channel package. Prior to that, there was only 4 or 5 channels, ABC, CBS, NBC, PBS. And so I'm going through my 30 channels, and I find, I get down, all 29 channels are good. ESPN, it's 24 Hours of Sports, and HBO, and ESPN, and movies, MTV, music. I get down to channel 30, and it's Discovery, and there's nothing there but bars on the screen.
Right.
So I'm like, I called the cable company. I said, hey, there's a problem. I'm getting 29 of the 30 channels. Nothing's coming through on channel 30. And they said, oh, Discovery is only an 18-hour-a-day network. It's a startup channel. They run a 6-hour block 3 times in 18 hours. They don't want to run it again. And so we just put bars up. So that's when the light bulb went off. I've got to fill that time.
Right.
And so I used to do a lot of trade shows, and I call it my curiosity overload phase. I'm selling all these businesses. So I'm going to the restaurant shows and the flower shows and the home and gardens
right.
shows. And
right.
I see this guy pitching the Ginsu knife at Philadelphia Home Show. He's cutting through a Coca-Cola can, a muffler, a pair of sneakers. Just a mesmerizing pitch. And his name was Arnold Morris. This is all he does for a living. He goes from show to show, 40 weeks a year for a dozen years. And that's when I say to Arnold, hey, look, I don't know if you know this, but Discovery Channel, 6 hours a day, has nothing. Why don't we film your pitch and put it on Discovery? And this is when I started products. So this is 1984, and I cut a deal with Discovery in Cincinnati, Ohio. We just were on local, but I said, okay, I want to do something for that downtime. They said, okay, they had a studio, and this is the birth of cable back in the day. We have a studio for local entrepreneurs.
Right.
We'll produce the show, and we'll run it 30 times. I said, oh my God, what's that 30-minute shows? So they're going to run 900 minutes, and they're going to produce it. I said, how much is that going to cost? Oh, $800, okay? That includes the production.
Right, yeah, that's crazy.
I'm in. Here's the $800, right. Okay? We shot it. $800, we did $226,000 in sales. And so I'm like, I'm in a new business now. I like those return on investment, right? So then Arnold said, Kevin, this is unbelievable. He's getting a royalty. And they're small numbers in the beginning because we're selling hundreds of thousands of dollars worth. But I'm just taking the local time.
Right.
So then I went to Discovery Nationwide. And I said, what are you doing? You know, nothing. They said, you want the time? I said, yeah, I'll give you $1,000 a day for the time, nationwide. So they took it. We signed a multi-year contract.
Yeah.
And for $365,000 a year, I own 6 hours a day on the National Discovery Network.
That's amazing.
And this is back in the mid-80s now. So on our third year of that contract, we were doing $28 million
That's
in sales.
Insane.
It was just unbelievable.
Now, how long was the multi-year contract?
3 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wish it had been 400.
I wish it had been 10 years, too, because Discovery was growing.
Right.
And, you know, so they were in 20 million homes, then 40 million, then 60 million. And so Saturday morning at 8 a.m., was like prime time for infomercials.
Yeah.
And I owned it on Discovery under this multi-year contract. The day that contract expired, they got $30 million for that time that I was buying for $365.
No kidding.
Bailed out on the bid because I'm like, you know, no, I'm not going to pay $30 million for it. But that's when the business started getting very competitive. Mm-hmm. The Guthrie Rankers were in the business now, other people selling skincare. And now the industry was starting, you know, this was now kind of late 80s and it was full-fledged. Our next thing was we would invest all this money into like a Tony Little, the Gazelle, a Jack LaLanne, the Juicer, George Foreman, whatever. We had to produce the manufacture the product, sometimes do the tooling. Mm-hmm. We had to shoot the infomercial and everything was a bell-shaped curve, just like a movie. You know, it goes in, hits a peak and it might last 18 months, a couple of years, but eventually, it would die.
Right.
And this is even in the 80s, before we even went to retail, because we didn't even realize the retailers were kind of like competitors. They looked at us, we sell direct to the consumer. So does Walmart. So eventually, these things started getting so much media behind them that people would go in the store and say, hey, do you have that Tony Little thing?
Right.
No, we don't carry that. That's
TV stuff.
You know, the TV, But then I acquired As Seen on TV, .com. Which that was the only IP in the world of As Seen on TV because the actual logo As Seen on TV, nobody owned. Nobody could claim it because it was generically used.
And is that the case to this day?
Still to this day. I owned As Seen on TV Inc.
Right.
And As Seen on TV.com.
Nice.
Because that was the only IP that you could have.
Right.
Was .com.
Right.
And the Inc. So we were getting millions of dollars a month in sales without a dime of advertising.
Because everybody says
because everybody
seen on TV.
Would just Google As Seen on TV.
So
it was just net profit, big time. So we were the As Seen on TV guys, but everything had a bell-shaped curve. I said, just like a movie, but what do movies do? And I tuned into researching the movie industry. Once a year, they go to the Cannes Film Festival and they sell the rights to the world.
Right.
To TV stations and to movie theaters around the world. So I went to the Cannes Film Festival, 1990. I took out a little 10-foot by 10-foot booth. And we were actually handing out video cassette tapes with a dollar taped to them. And we said, we're going to pay you to run our TV shows. And we're going to pay you just to watch it as a, you know, here's a dollar. All you got to do is watch this VHS tape. And you get a dollar to watch it because every time you run it, we'll pay you. In your market. This was against the model of the movie industry.
Right.
They charged for the movie.
Right.
So, in other words, every other booth in the entire conference was there to do one thing, to sell their TV show or their movie to the people walking the floor. We said, we pay you to run our shows. And they're like, wait a minute. what's the catch? Okay. I mean, literally, Rupert Murdoch is there. Sheikh Saleh Kamel and his team from Arab Radio Television, the Kinnevik family from Sweden, the Marcucci family from Italy, every TV network in the world, TV Tokyo from Japan. They're like, you're going to pay us to run kitchen shows? Yeah. At the end of the show, we're going to sell the product.
Right.
We're going to give you a percentage of the sales. We're going to pay you to run it. They're like, when can we start? And we
it was that easy. So it was
boom. We launched in England, which went on Astra Satellite, 16 countries in Europe. And this was the amazing thing. When we first launched on Sky Channel with Rupert Murdoch, we thought we're running on the Sky Channel.
Right.
It's in England. We're getting orders from Italy, from Germany, from France, all over the continent, because it was on satellite. Oh. So everyone that has a satellite dish, of which there was 40 million of them across Europe, is seeing our shows. So I sat with the team at Sky Channel and I said, so we're getting all these orders. These Germans and French are calling in their language. We don't have, we're only in English.
Right.
They said, oh, guess what? We can lease you audio channels in the local language, and then they can pull it down in their local language. So one video track, 8 audio tracks went out. And so now the German people are listening to it in German, simultaneous to the Italians listening to it in Italian.
You did the French, translation?
We did all that,
okay,
all across Europe. And then we set up local fulfillment centers in each country, because when the Germans called, they wanted that product right away. We had German instructions, and these were kitchen products primarily, the Food Saver and Arnold Morris's knives and Billy Mays. And then we got into fitness with Tony Little, but the Jack LaLanne juicer. And all we had to do, well, with juicers, we had to get the electrical. So we had to start doing, you know, the local kind of UL and,
right,
and all of that. But this was the birth of infomercials around the world. So we went to Europe, Middle East, Latin America, partnered with the media companies.
So that's brilliant. One of the things that holds a lot of people, including us and our businesses, back, I think, going internationally, is how do I get my stuff translated? And how do I get people who are going to be calling in different languages? I don't have customer support for that. How do I do that? And you said you set up fulfillment centers. How does somebody go about getting those hurdles cleared?
Yeah, so what I would do is I started attending direct marketing conferences existed in Europe. I'll never forget, went to one of the first ones I went to was in Montreux, and there's Joe Sugarman, okay? And this is before Joe did Blue Blockers,
right,
but,
right,
you know, because this was back in the early 80s. So catalogs existed. So my partner in Germany was Otto. They were Otto Versand was the biggest catalog company. They were in the business of shipping products, taking orders, and shipping products to their, okay, consumers. So I went into existing infrastructures, partnered with them, and said, look, I'm just going to be blasting things on TV. I'll send them to your call center. You'll be my fulfillment partner. And so we partnered with phone center, like catalog type operators, okay, for the operational side.
So how would you find, if you're an online, somebody's listening to this and they've got a .com and they want to do that, what would you tell them to do now? What would the step be?
Well, today, most of the stuff is done online. So if you didn't translate into the local language, the people that are ordering in English.
Right.
So, you know, until you start tailoring it to the local market, you don't necessarily need to, really.
But let's say that you do. You've translated, yeah, now.
So to this day, I still have about 100 plus international connections with the biggest and the best guys that do this stuff, mm-hmm, in the local markets.
And if you were starting out, what would you do?
So
you didn't have that.
If you didn't have that, it's a good question. I would, today, you've got a lot of Amazon sellers now that are starting to sell, mm-hmm, in a lot of the international markets.
Right.
So that would be one way to go. We are tying in some of the Amazon guys also, because some of my old connections, actually, they're bigger players now. They're not just fulfillment players, so they're not really as much interested in just, oh, can I fulfill Kevin's goods?
Right.
You know, they want to be the distributor and kind of own the product for their whole country,
right,
and take all the distribution. But I think what I would do is I would go into these international organizations. You mentioned EO, for example. When I went to Shanghai not too long ago, I got in there, put out an announcement, hey, I'm going to be in town for 3 days. Anybody have any connections for fulfillment, customer service,
okay,
credit card processing? Because today, it's more and more difficult to get merchant accounts and all that kind of stuff, right?
Right.
So I had about 20 people that actually came and said, I'm going to be hanging out at a lunch at this place. Anybody wants to come, come on down. And I had 20 people that showed up for a little luncheon that I put together of local people in Shanghai.
That's really cool.
So I had to go there and be there and do that.
Right.
But you could do that virtually, or you could, as one of the founders of EO, it's a little easier for me to get some traction in some of these markets.
Sure.
But EO is a great connector because you got people that do all of those things in every one of those EO chapters. And I think 12,500 members in more than 150 cities in 55 countries.
Right.
So EO is great. I mean, Traffic and Conversion is going to be launching around the world. Yep. So you're going to be connecting in with a lot of global players, but also direct marketing networking organizations.
Are there any main big ones that you would tell people to check out?
Unfortunately, it used to be ERA, which, because ERA did a show every year in Monte Carlo, the European show, and then they did an Asian show in Hong Kong, and they did a Latin American show in Miami. Mm-hmm. And I met all my connections all through ERA. They picked up a new organization. I think it's called PDMI, and they have a big event coming up in Miami. But the world of electronic commerce, e-commerce, is there's a lot of people out there that do all of these things. And of course, Amazon is a great a partner to tune into also. So any local Amazon sellers is another good place to go.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about what you're doing now, because I think that's kind of interesting. You've done so many different things and you see so many opportunities, and you've got great deal flow from all of the experience that you've had. And you've chosen to do a couple of things now, the key person of influence and some stuff like that. Can we talk a little bit about that?
So my life is built in three buckets. One is I'm still in a product business, and I've been for 35 years a product guy. So I've got right now about a dozen products that I own, some on QVC, some on HSN, some in retail. It's no longer you got to use as seen on TV to build them. You know, we have an item that we've sold 2.7 million pieces of. It's never seen television. It's all been through digital and now retail. And we're in Walmart and Target. It's an eyeglass cleaning product called Peeps. And it will be over $100 million in sales.
Is it shaped like little chickens and it comes out during Easter time?
That's what it looks like. People thought it was that little marshmallow thing, right? It's a double-sided, I didn't bring one with me today, but it's a double-sided cleaning system that is very demonstrable. So that's one of our products. We've sold 600,000 pieces on QVC, QVC US, QVC UK, France, Italy, Germany. So we're still in the global distribution business of products. That's one bucket.
So let's talk about that bucket for a minute to help you in case there's anybody listening that might want to get in touch with you, and B, for somebody that just has a product. What makes a successful product now these days? What do you look for?
What I look for is proof of concept somewhere. Has it been successful in a catalog? Has it been successful on a shopping channel? Is it in retail?
And how do you define success?
Has it been tested on a digital test?
Okay.
Building a funnel. So Peeps, for example, when we first got it, we didn't know if it had legs. So we took it to QVC. They turned it down. They said, come back when you've got, some sales somewhere. And so we put it on Facebook and Instagram. And on $2,500 in ads, we're generating a more than 4-time multiple.
That's
for
pretty
sales.
Good. Yeah.
Okay. So, we said, okay. And so, and at $100,000 in ads, it was still generating more than 400,000 in sales, credit card orders.
Right.
So we were tweaking it, getting the average order value up. And because this was a $15 item, but it really supercharged when we were average order was in the mid 20s. And the affiliates came to us and said, if you can pay us $18, we will be able to sell 5,000 to 10,000 pieces a day.
Okay.
So we had to then get the average order up. We got it up to over $50. We were able to pay the 18, and that then just rocketed the product.
Are you using agencies for the Facebook ads, like when you're starting to test that?
Yeah. Okay. We use outside agencies, correct. We pretty much don't do anything in-house, and we build the funnels. We shoot videos. We shoot the videos ourselves because that's the one thing that we've been doing for 35 years.
Right.
So I own a studio called Pitch Video in a partnership with another gentleman. And so we shoot the videos. We build the funnels through third parties and then test the ads.
Okay.
So we got Peeps up to, at its peak, 15,000 pieces a day last December because it was huge for Christmas.
Strictly online?
Strictly online, okay. Yeah. And then we just started QVC and a little bit of retail then.
So you got the traction first, then QVC says, okay, you can sell that. So
yes. So we're now in Walmart, Target, QVC, and digital still. So it's still, and then Amazon's doing very well. So bucket one, we still sell products.
Okay.
Bucket two, I've been involved in various, you know, advisory type things. We talked about it.
Right.
I'm on boards, advisory boards. So I've got equity in probably north of 15 companies where I have a monthly obligation to provide services, whether it be board services, attending board phone calls, board meetings, advisory calls. And some of these are, they're definitely monthly and quarterly obligations.
Okay.
So that's a lot of fun. And I love doing that because I get paid generally some kind of monthly fee as well as stock participation. And so I love to help build those companies. And
if somebody wants to be an advisor, what would you advise the potential would be advisors to do in cutting a deal like that?
Advisors should look at being able to get, if a company wants to hire four advisors, they should plan on giving up at least 25% of the company to four people. That's 1%, maybe 0.5% of the company, mm-hmm. four people. You get four strong advisors for 1-2% of the equity. Can be very, very powerful because the right advisors can bring you other advisors, get you press, raise your money, and give you access to the Rolodex.
Right.
You know?
And what about like a fee on top of the equity?
Yeah. And a fee would be generally they start kind of a low end of about $1,000 a month. And some boards can pay. I mean, I know boards that pay $500,000 a year to
right.
belong to. I'm not on any of those. Those are kind of like the big ones.
Are you open to that if anybody wants to do that, to pay you $500 a year and give you equity in their company?
Absolutely open to that. Thank you, Roland. That's very, very kind of you. Yeah, let's give him a special phone number to call for that one, okay? You know, like a buddy of mine, he retired from a company called J-Bill, mm-hmm. and it's a $20 billion circuit board company, and he sits on Quest's board
right. okay.
and a few other boards, and, you know, he's getting hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. You know, these are all publicly disclosed figures and
right.
stuff, so
right.
he gets stock, and you know what I love? I joined the board of a company. It was $1 a share. And so I said, you know what? I'll get some board comp, but I'll buy 100,000 shares also, right? And the stock ends up going to $18. So, you know, it's like, I love when I get, you know, when I bought stock, it was very positive news, but, you know, and so that helped the market for a little bit,
right.
but it's, you know, but then the company grew. And so it's like, you get stock, you can buy some stock, you,
yeah.
you know, believe in the companies you work with. So the public market for me has been fantastic. So I love that. And then my third bucket is I'm speaking and I do events on a global basis. I have one group of, that I mentioned to you earlier, How to Become an Industry Rock Star. That is, we do about 20 of those a year around the world. And we do Europe, we do Asia, we do the US and have a nice business there. But then I do like, you know, kind of corporate speaking. 2 weeks ago, I was at Microsoft's headquarters for a day. Akon, the rapper and myself were brought in to do a bunch of stuff for a day up there. So that's like corporate events that I do that are paid events, right?
Right.
And you know, the funny thing is you know, I'm from AT&T to Microsoft to Pfizer Pharmaceutical, the United States Postal Service, they pay a fee, but then almost every time there's some kind of back-end tie-in, you know, they want some consulting. Microsoft is now bringing me to do sort of these Shark Tank style events all around there. I've now done over 4 events for Microsoft. So AT&T, they wanted me to come in and give them a consulting proposal, which I'm, you know, putting together now. So that's the kind of stuff that happens when you speak. It leads to other things, and it's pretty powerful in the world of corporate universe
sure.
to be doing some of that kind of stuff.
So
that's sort of a tie into the old Shark Tank. You know, the Shark Tank branding has been good because I did a couple seasons. I did 175 segments,
mm-hmm.
and there's 5 segments to a 1-hour show.
Okay.
35 total 1-hour shows, and those rerun on CNBC. They rerun on a global basis. So I'm going to India. Shark Tank is running on prime time in India, but they went back to season one
right.
and started running the early shows.
That's really cool.
So it's been a global branding thing for me too.
The things that you're doing, let's talk about the key person of influence.
Yeah.
Why did you decide to do it? What is it? How could people get involved with you?
In the product world, we do physical products. So we still do, you know, like eyeglass cleaning products, and we do ingestibles and B12 vitamin type things. But we also do Info Products. So I've been involved with the Zig Ziglar family for a number of years. Zig passed away 6 years ago, and I met Tom Ziglar and Cindy and the family and Julie. And I said, what did you do with all the assets of Zig? And, you know, they continued to sell them over the years, but sales have been dwindling over the last 6 years. So I said, let's bring it back. Let's digitize it. So we signed a deal to acquire the exclusive rights to all of the Zig Ziglar content for the world of digital. Myself and Mark Tim became partners with the family. And so this is one of the digital products that we've been launching. Secrets of Closing the Sale Masterclass is the first product that we've put out.
Is there a site for it?
Yeah, it's ZigSecrets.com.
Okay.
People can go check that out. And that is 28 modules. And each module has two videos. It's a video of that I produced myself, and we took the best of Zig. So it's the best of Zig, and then it's me, and I'm bringing Zig's story and closing techniques over to the current day of how I've used them in digital as well as the infomercial business that I created. So we're learning how to sell, and this has now been a pretty successful program for us with Zig Ziglar. We also have something that we call How to Become a Key Person of Influence, which comes out of my book. The book is called How to Become a Key Person of Influence, but we're now putting on classes for that, training programs, mentoring, and coaching. So,
and what's the site for that?
That's freekpibook.com.
Okay. So, now, what's the benefit to people of doing this, to become a key person of influence?
Yeah.
Why is that important?
So in the world of entrepreneurship, there's all different kinds of entrepreneurs, but particularly entrepreneurs in the service world, folks that are dentists, chiropractors, lawyers, speakers, coaches, mentors, people that provide services like that. How do you, and real estate agents, mortgage brokers, right? How do you raise your profile in the marketplace and become the go-to person? How do you get the phone call from, I have a friend of mine lives in Cincinnati and he has a real estate company and he deals with all the ball players that are moving in from out of town, from, you know, new Bengals, new Reds, you know, in Cincinnati. And so how does he get those phone calls?
Right.
He's raised his profile. He's become a key person of influence in the real estate industry. So how did he do it? I recommend people do it. Well, you can't just sit there. You've got to get out. You've got to be speaking. You've got to be creating content. You got to write books. You got to have a podcast. You've got to be very proactive. And in the world of digital, it's amazing the opportunities that are out there for folks that can just start putting out content. And I started speaking myself, and it came about from Shark Tank. I got an offer to go speak at a place. When I got done, they said, wow, we kept waiting for you to tell us you were going to charge us a fee, and you never said it cost anything, so thank you. But we had a $10,000 budget for this.
Right.
You know? And I'm like, wow, you mean I can put my name out there, build my brand, and get paid at the same time. It's pretty amazing, right? So I said, I got to be putting out books. But also, when I do these speeches, put that content out on the internet and do a weekly podcast. And so there's a guy, and I don't know if you know Ed Mylett.
Oh, yeah.
Ed? Okay.
I haven't met him yet. He's supposed to meet, I think, in the next couple of days, actually.
Okay. Yeah. So Ed called me up. Hey, Kevin, I'm doing a podcast. You want to be on my podcast? I said, Ed, I'd love to. Sure. So I went out to his house in Laguna Beach.
Yep.
And you haven't been
That's
there
where
yet.
We're going.
Okay,
yeah.
Yeah. You're going to love it. So we filmed the podcast, video, audio, the whole thing. And it airs. He says, Kevin, 6 million downloads from this podcast, this little interview we did.
Wow.
And this is how you build your brand. This is how you get out there, get on podcasts. I mean, how did Oprah Winfrey build her billions of dollars? She started creating a lot of content, interviewing experts on the Oprah show, right? And so you're not going to do it sitting at home. You get out there. So how do you leverage yourself in today's world? You know, there's so many great opportunities. How did Kylie Jenner become a billionaire? She's got 100 million people following her on Instagram. So now she comes from the Kardashian family. So she had a little bit of an edge there, but there's people.
And I think there was a GoFundMe to help push her over the billion because people were concerned she wasn't going to make it.
Right. So, so the world of Instagram and Twitter and all this, I mean, I've got just shy of 1 million people following me now. And it's like, the more people you have following you, the more income potential you have. You go into LinkedIn, go into Instagram, go and just go out there, build your profile, write books, create content, put it out on a regular basis, and you're going to start seeing the fruits of that come through in big time sales.
So the key person of influence is a system for doing that?
Yeah, it's a 5-step system that includes also creating amazing partnerships.
Okay.
And so we teach you a lot of these different things. Partnerships are one of the most amazing things that I've done. When I met Arnold Morris back in the early 80s, and Arnold said, and I'm like, well, how can I do this deal with Arnold? He's the Ginsu guy. He's like, Kevin, you don't have to be the inventor. You can partner with the people that own these products, and I'll show you how to do it. And so I'm like, you mean I can be a partner with the Ginsu? I didn't own Ginsu. I didn't create Ginsu. I partnered with Ginsu, and we sold hundreds of millions of dollars worth of knives with Arnold in the process. So we launched a mobile app a few years ago, and I think you remember the Star Shop.
Yeah, we
app,
went
right?
to...
You went to Sprint's headquarters.
Yeah.
They put us on 6 million phones. And believe it or not, they're still in business. And we may have just sold the company.
Oh, so, congratulations. That's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, there's finally might be an upside to, you know, the building of that whole business.
Right.
We raised $8 million for that company, by the way.
Did you? Okay.
Yeah. And so everyone would love to, you know, make more than their $8 million back, but it looks like that might happen.
So let's close with the partnership thing, because partnerships are, for me, also 100%. Yep. I don't own 100% of anything I do.
Right.
And I'm really happy because it allows you to do the things you're good at and get in business with other people who are good at the other things that you don't want to
exactly.
do, don't like to do, right?
Yeah.
So tell me, how do you, because a lot of people, when I talk about partnerships, they say, I'm scared of that. I've heard of all the horror stories. And for me, it's generally been good, but I'd love to hear your take on how do you decide who a good partner is and how do you create a good partnership?
Yeah. So one of the things that I try to do, and a group came to me once, they were in the business of selling products to the military, and they wanted me to help them out. And so I said, you know, you wanted me to join like their board, their advisory board. And I said, okay, let me take a look at the opportunity. So I said, hey, look, I live in Tampa, Florida. MacDill Air Force Base is there also. I said, I know there's a lot of retired generals that come out of MacDill. And what are they looking for? These guys are still young men that are, you know, in their 50s or 60s. And hey, look, why don't we get a retired general to join your advisory
Pretty
board?
Great idea.
Let's partner with a retired general. And they're like, oh, well, why do you think they'd want to join us? Well, first we're going to put out a press release that I've joined your board. And then we're going to take that and go to talk to two or three of these guys and say, we're looking to choose one of you, okay? And so now it's not, you've got to sell them. You're picking the one that's best for you because there's a business there. That's how retired generals monetize themselves. They want to be on boards, but we wanted them to sell us. So we actually met with a couple generals and we ended up picking Chip Deal to be the guy and he joined our board and boom, now we're off to the races. We got a great partnership with him and we got into AFES, which is the division of the military that buys for the military out of
Helpful.
Dallas. They do $20 billion a year in product purchases for the military.
Wow.
So the military, as consumers, they need toilet paper and all kinds of things
Sure.
on a day-to-day basis, right? When they're living. So anyway, make a long story short, I try to bring some key people of influence into a deal
Right.
to get that can open up a Rolodex.
Okay.
I mean, why do people go on Shark Tank? They want Mark Cuban to be their advisor or their
Right.
partner so they can get access to all of the connections that he's got. Basically, creating partnerships, if you've got somebody that has a good intro into the deal, that's better. I've got a beauty deal I'm doing right now, and I'm bringing in the former president of L'Oreal to help me in that venture. So
Right.
I like to get people involved that can bring a halo effect to the deal. And that generally is a good way to start.
Okay, so we got the halo effect. And then is there anything else that you look for in a partner that's kind of a must have?
Well, I want a partner that's going to make some commitments. Because when we did the deal with Sprint in this mobile app business, we were giving them 25% equity in the venture. But we had a quantification of what they were going to deliver
Right.
to the venture.
Right.
So they were going to build the app, number one. They were, number two, going to put it on 1 million phones a month for 6 months.
Right.
Because that's how many new phone activations they have every
Right.
month. They were going to do digital blasts into their network of people. So we quantified what they were willing to do. And hey, who better than a cell phone company to be a partner in a mobile app because
Yep.
they can put the mobile app right on the cell phone
Right.
as they sell cell phones. So I like a partner that's going to make some commitments
Okay.
and quantify their involvement, especially if they're going to get equity.
Okay.
Because we talked earlier, we tried to give Sprint equity as they performed.
Right.
No, they were smart. Their lawyer said, we want it all up front. You claw it back if we don't perform.
Which is how you like to do a deal.
Which is how I like to do the deal. So we couldn't argue too much about that. But we love a partner that can obviously bring as much influence on the relationship, but where they're going to actually commit to doing things along the way.
Okay. And then are there any kind of red flags or things that where you go, I'm not going to, that's probably not the right partnership for me?
Initially, we want a very powerful press release on the front end that kind of, you know, consummates the deal. So if we find somebody squealing about a powerful press release or they're not wanting to do this, that's generally, you know, if we can't get a really powerful press announcement,
okay,
because that really has to set the tone of the whole thing to start. So we'd like to get some video shot with key people. We want to get some great quotes. We want to get access to, you know, a good Rolodex and commitments that we can monitor over. You know, initially, it's important in the early days of a partnership to be getting performance up front. Because if you're not getting it up front, you're going to be getting less of it 9 months later.
For sure.
So it's important to, you know, to stoke it on the front end. So if we have obstacles with those press releases and things on the front end, that's a sign we're going to have problems.
Okay.
And we'll back out then.
Okay.
As long as we've got, you know, a tight contract and they're starting in, you know, I say dealing in good faith, you know, we're feeling pretty good about getting something kicked off.
Okay.
It depends on how much equity we've got to give up also, you know, so.
Is there a preferred amount? Is there a, like kind of a zone of, or a range that you like to be in?
You know, look, it's, if you're dealing with influencers, I mean, when we were dealing with Flo Rida, for example, you got to be careful with celebrities because they'll, oh yeah, well, I'll do a tweet, right? Now, we got lucky with Flo because he wanted $1 million cash. Mm-hmm. Said, look, we're not writing you a check, okay? So we ended up giving him stock. And so we gave him 1 million shares of stock when it was 10 cents a share. But he saw—
And this was publicly traded?
This was publicly traded stock. So it was a monetization for him of at least— he could say, okay, I'm getting $100,000, but he couldn't sell it for a year.
Right, right.
That stock's now almost $4. So he ended up making some good money on that. But he actually over-delivered. I mean, this guy, we had in the contract, you got to go to trade shows. We want X number, you know, I think it was 2 a year. So we took him to the trade show where all the buyers of energy drinks, this is a company called Celsius, and he performed a private concert for all the buyers of energy drinks from Publix, from Vitamin Shop, from Walmart, et cetera. 20 people, private concert, pretty cool thing. Well, 7-Eleven, we got the 7-Eleven account that weekend that he did this.
Wow.
So you want to create a win-win situation. Now, by the way, Flo saw his stock went from 10 cents to $1.50 to $3.
He's pretty happy.
He was pretty excited about participating.
Right.
So I say you got to cut a fair deal for both sides. I never mind, hey, if he made $3 or $4 million, God bless him. That's fantastic because he was part of helping make that happen.
Right.
And he actually was helpful in raising capital too, the fact that Flo was on. And by the way, we sent him tons of cases of product. And he said, okay, I need a case to go to Khloe Kardashian, to this one. And what was happening? Khloe's tweeting for no charge.
Right.
I love this Celsius, right? So that was all because of Flo.
Right.
I mean, and that you'd pay $200,000 for that tweet. So we really leveraged Flo. And it's important on the front end, if it's a win-win and both sides are going to participate in the upside, it, you know, for Flo, it worked out great. We've had some other ones that didn't work out as well. And you live and you learn, but you want to be able to claw back if they don't perform.
And so the last question, if you're going to do a partnership or you want to do a partnership with an influencer slash celebrity like Flo, how do you approach them? What's the best way? Is it find their agent? Is it—
I mean, if you can get to them directly, that's obviously even better because their managers and their agents will sometimes drive the price up. I don't like to talk negative about managers or agents because I deal with many of them.
Sure.
That's their job.
Just another layer, and that's what they do.
I have a manager and an agent myself, and you know, some people call me and say, that guy, he drives way too hard a bargain.
Right.
And I can't afford you. And so I sit and I say, well, let's take another look at it and see if we can make it work. But I think the bottom line is I make sure the manager, so the, you know, the manager gets a percentage of that stock also. So we tell the manager right up front, we want you to be participating in all the streams that, you know, everybody is. So we are friendly with these guys. We know these folks. And at the end of the day, they're out to get the best deal they can. Not every deal is going to pay off like the Flo did for Flo himself. But I think the important thing is making sure that the manager understands that one tweet isn't going to make a business relationship
work.
So
right.
we really need, you know, we're not, I'm not in the business of buying one tweet.
Yeah.
I'm in the business of long-term relationships and having something that lasts for as long a time as possible. And then also giving them that upside, that, you know, that little equity kicker if possible. It's a lot easier when you're public also.
Yeah. Yeah.
For sure.
Okay. So thanks so much for being here. What is the best place if someone wants to hire you to speak? Where would they go and who would they talk to?
Yeah. So they can go to kevinharrington.tv is my website. There's a place on there to get to our speaking group. And so kevinharrington.tv is a good place to start. If they want to contact you directly, you can always put them in touch with me directly. I'm happy if on a case-by-case basis for any special referrals from you, Roland, you could give them my direct email.
Okay.
But I don't want to put that out on this, but kevinharrington.tv for a website, or I'm sure you can track me down somewhere if you have a special friend or a client that needs some special services.
Okay. And then for the key person of influence?
FreeKPIBook.com. And for Zig, it's ZigSecrets.com.
Okay. And are there any other places, like if they have a product or anything like that, that they're interested in showing you, or talking to you about?
Right through the website. Kevin Harrington.tv.
Okay. And do you have a podcast now?
I do have a podcast.
What's
it's
the podcast?
Called Sharkpreneur.
Sharkpreneur.
Seth Green and I do a weekly podcast, and we're building some traction with that. So we're looking to have some folks on there. I don't think we've ever had you on there, so maybe we can get you on one of our future events here coming
Fantastic.
Up.
Fantastic. Awesome. Super. Well, thank you again for being here and taking the time, and happy pre-anniversary also to you and your wife.
Hey, it's my anniversary this weekend. Thanks, Roland. Great to be here.
You've been listening to Business Lunch with Roland Frazier. For more information, go to businesslunchpodcast.com. Thank you for listening.